Thank you, Michael, for the invitation to come here. It's always a pleasure to visit KITP. So I would like to tell you about our work on ferromagnetic 3-5s, primarily gallium manganese arsenide. And it might be appropriate to start this talk with a bold statement, or rather understatement, by Pauli, who was quoted as saying back in 1931 that one shouldn't work with semiconductors. That's a filthy mess. Who knows where they really exist? And of course, today semiconductors are some of the cleanest materials of all available. In free paths, in high mobility samples, can be as long as microns. But filthy semiconductors have been attracting a lot of attention recently, starting from this work of Hideo and collaborators, who have been able to introduce a new class of magnetic semiconductors of 3-5s. Before this work, most of the magnetic semiconductors were 2-6s and oxides. So this was a very important achievement that soon has led to an observation of ferromagnetism in a variety of 3-5 materials, and in ferromagnetism at fairly high Curie temperatures. There are also reports, several reports, for ferromagnetic state in group 4 materials, although it's a little bit less clear if the group 4 systems should be viewed as if magnetic impurities there cluster, and what's the role of clusters there is less unclear. I have nothing against clusters. It's just a different problem from a problem of doped semiconductor. And gallium manganese arsenide appears to be an example of a doped ferromagnetic semiconductor. While interesting in itself, ferromagnetism in all these and other systems is also appealing in the context of opportunities to control and manipulate magnetic state in all these systems. And this is the material on which we have focused so far, and most of our results are for this compound. It's a little bit less. So I think these two are definitely doped semiconductors. This is sort of questionable, and I think most of the works would agree that these are definitely not doped semiconductors, but alloys of manganese residing in this host. The field of spin-related phenomena is remarkably active, and certainly this workshop is a solid indicator of activity in this field, in the progress of spintronics. And yet another indicator is a sheer number of publications in this area. While preparing for this talk, I checked the number of articles published in the general area of spin-related phenomena in semiconductors, and that's how I got this number. So different search engines would produce slightly different results. So I averaged them and obtained 17,900 to 1 over the last 5 years. That amounts to approximately 10 papers a day, including weekends and holidays. So one paper per every 2 hours, approximately. So with a very high probability, somebody will publish another article during this hour that I have. Yes, that's including both fundamental physics and applied physics. Anyway, so this is the outline of my talk. And first I will quickly overview some of the basic facts about gallium manganese arsenide, something that would be relevant to our work. And then I would like to say a few words about alternative doping schemes, specifically about electrostatic doping. The scheme has already been tried by Hideo, but I think we can make there is a hope to make progress with this alternative way of doping using alternative gate insulators. And we haven't done this experiment, but we've done most of the homework for this experiment, so I'm really interested to discuss opportunities for that. Then I will spend most of my time talking about two viewpoints on the electronic structure of gallium manganese arsenide, two viewpoints on where the action really happens in this doped semiconductors, whether ferromagnetism has something to do with states in the impurity band or states in the valence band. And I'll try to convince you that optical experiments help us to discriminate between these two possibilities, and I think it's important to discriminate between these two possibilities because the understanding of the band structure is a prerequisite of understanding of ferromagnetism. It's generally agreed that the valence band picture would favor an RKKY type of mechanism, whereas impurity band picture would favor maybe double exchange or some other exotic mechanism. I'll try to tell you that optical experiments are helpful to resolve this issue. There is actually a lively debate on this topic in the literature, and while some groups would suggest that the RKKY description is firmly established for this class of materials, others would refer it to something with a question mark, or would state that maybe this is a completely inappropriate form of describing ferromagnetic state. I will let theorists to decide on that, but I think I totally agree with an opening line from a recent paper by Sankar Dasarma and Yin Zhang, who started this work by saying that a central open question in the physics of carrier-mediated ferromagnetism is the nature of the semiconductor carriers mediating the ferromagnetic interaction. And I think we, using experimental tools that we have, we are in the position to give more, definitive answers to this question. These answers come from the analysis of the doping trends in the optical conductivity, also from the analysis of the effective masses of holes, of doped holes using some rules. And I think both of these ways to look at the data really support the view of the impurity band. I think this view is also consistent with a number of other spectroscopies, including magnetic circular dichroism, STM artist photoluminescence, and some of the anomalies of transport also make sense in terms of this picture. In fact, we have already reported back in 2002, evidence for the impurity band in gallium manganese arsenide. But we were told by our theory friends that these results are inconclusive because this work has been carried out for samples with fairly low TC. They were disordered, they were heavily compensated. And I think this was a fair objection. Since 2002, the work carried out in several groups has been able to improve the quality of gallium manganese arsenide significantly, and TC has also improved as a result of that. And it took us a while to investigate this new class of high TC ferromagnetic semiconductors, and yet in these new materials with TC as high as one can possibly get for the manganese concentrations that we looked at, we still find firm evidence for the impurity band. There is this last issue that I would like to address very briefly, and that's the role of inhomogeneities in all of this. This conclusion of the impurity band, I think, is pretty irrefutable, provided thin films that we and other groups look at are homogeneous. And they, you know, experience with other heavily doped systems tells us that they do not have to be homogeneous. At the moment, there is no firm experimental evidence for inhomogeneous electronic states, at least in the doping level that we investigated, on which we focused. But we are trying to set up new measurements that hopefully will help us to be a little bit more quantitative on this issue. Yes. Well, okay. So samples processed in a similar fashion to the samples that we have investigated have been claimed to have zero compensation. So it's from our measurements alone, there might be a way to infer compensation level from our measurements alone, but we really have not attempted to do that. But based on everything we know from other groups who have used exactly the same annealing protocols for our films as they used for the films they have systematically studied with transport, with hold, with everything. So these films have low level of compensation. I don't think it's zero, but I think it's fairly low. Okay, and I would like to leave some time in the end for discussion and for questions. And please feel free to ask questions anytime, of course. It's a pleasure to acknowledge my collaborators. All new unpublished work is a work of Kenneth Birch with some participation of David Schreckenhammer. Kenny has left San Diego and he's now at Los Alamos. Earlier results is the work of Jason Singley. Our first samples that we looked at were grown by Roland Kawakami, and later samples were made for us by Jason Stephens in David Ashland's lab. This annealing, post-growth annealing, is an essential part of this project, and we collaborated with Peter Schiffer and Nathan Sommerath on this part. Okay. How does one make gallium-manganese arsenide ferromagnetic? One has to put a lot of manganese in it. In fact, you achieve ferromagnetic state if your manganese concentration somewhere in the range. The left edge is okay now, but the right is. Thank you for your kind assistance. So one has to put a lot of manganese to make it ferromagnetic, more than you can put in bulk gallium arsenide. It's beyond the solubility limit. Solution was proposed by Hideo, I think, first, who used low temperature molecular beam epitaxy to grow 3,5s with manganese. As I already mentioned, our samples are coming from Santa Barbara, and this work would not have been possible without. Maybe one can unzoom it a little bit. Usually I have zoomed. That's an old-fashioned way to unzoom. Okay. Thank you. So our samples are coming from this campus, and our work would not have been possible without a systematic effort and MBE growth in David's lab and in other groups here in Santa Barbara. So when manganese produces a lot of different effects in gallium manganese arsenide, manganese delivers magnetic moments. Manganese also produces holes. Mobile holes in this system, and these films are inevitably disordered at concentration levels, at doping levels that we are discussing. There are plenty of defects in these films, and there are two important types of defects: arsenic anthracite and manganese interstitials. These defects are important because both of them control the electronic state of these semiconductors. And since ferromagnetism is carrier mediated, these defects also control the magnetic state in a major way. And I believe it's imperative to understand the interplay between all these effects if you want to achieve really high TC ferromagnetism at 3.5s. From the technological point of view, the new effects that have been discovered in these semiconductors are unlikely to play a major role if TC stays below the room temperature. This is one of the earliest reports of the phase diagram, perhaps the first phase diagram of gallium manganese arsenide from Hideo's group. TC was increasing as a function of concentration, then it would go down. I think a very important observation that they made is that based on transport properties, these three red samples showed metallic characteristics. These samples were insulating. And I think it's a very important point that ferromagnetism can be observed both in insulating and in metallic samples. Since that, many other groups have investigated in much more details the phase diagram. And this is a more recent result from 2005. So it became possible to integrate more manganese into the gallium arsenide host. But what is especially important that the annealing protocol, it allows you to increase the degree temperature from about 80 to maybe 180 at the highest manganese concentration. This annealing also improved the metallicity of these films, and specifically it has improved the carrier density. Carrier density also grows as with annealing. Conductivity increases with annealing, so these films, high TC ferromagnetic films, are much more metallic. Kenny Birch has recently came up with an interesting plot that I think captures some of the roles played by improved metallicity and increasing TC. So he has been able to scale a large amount of data coming from different groups, different labs around the world in the following way. So he has TC on the vertical axis, and on the horizontal axis he has a product of DC conductivity and manganese concentration. And for this large variety of samples, he found the square root dependence of TC as a function of this product. So starting from the Drude model, one can suggest that the DC conductivity here characterizes two separate effects. It characterizes increased carrier density T, but it also is related to disorder, to tau. And I think it's important that both factors are actually entering this scaling. If you are trying to scale TC just with T, just with carrier density, the scaling will not be as impressive. So it's really a combination of two that puts a lot of data points on the same diagram. I think this plot is quite informative because this product on the horizontal axis may suggest that if our goal is to achieve as high TC as possible, then we might be better off by putting less manganese, but perhaps by improving conductivity using alternative means. And people are trying to do this by designing very fancy heterostructures, and at least there is one report, or maybe several reports, of, I guess it's very hard to see what exactly is in this heterostructure. I apologize for this poor diagram that I copied from a paper, but important thing is TC in this heterostructures was as high as 250 Kelvin. Yes. X represents a product. X means manganese percent times sigma DC. I think it's about 2%. Pardon me? Yes, that's nominal manganese doping, yes. Yes. I think it's both before and after. So because what happens if you don't change manganese, but you anneal, both your TC and sigma goes up. So there are points for both. X is the same, yeah. Overdoped? What did? Yeah. I think the new films don't really get into this overdoped territory. So 10% is approximately the maximum manganese that you can put without producing obvious clusters. So TC is still gradually going up. It's not going down as it used to do in the earlier samples. That's one of the perhaps differences from the earlier data set. So strictly speaking, we are not in the overdoped territory anywhere here. So there is an alternative way to introduce doping. And Honor's group has pioneered that. And this alternative way is to dope charges electrostatically. And in order for this to happen, you have to integrate magnetic semiconductors into field effect transistor structures. And if you do that, then as Hideo has been able to demonstrate, you can change TC reversibly, at least by one Kelvin in this work. But it's not a big change, but it's a very important principle, advance, showing that TC can be controlled by the electric field. Later on, they were able to control coercivity as well. I think this idea of electrostatic doping is a great idea. It's also a very difficult experiment, and there are at least two challenges associated with this type of work. The first challenge is a gate insulator. It's very hard to fabricate gate insulators that would sustain electric fields that are needed to put substantial amount of charges in this material. In these early experiments, I think the density was on the level of 10 to the 12 curies per square centimeter. And of course, indium manganese arsenide and gallium manganese arsenide, if you have some manganese there, it's already doped with charges. So this is not a significant fraction of charges that you can introduce, and perhaps that's the reason why changes of TC are fairly modest. And I haven't seen similar work done on gallium manganese arsenide. Maybe I'm missing something in the literature. the other problem with this type of work is that the amount of probes accessible for us to investigate physics of the accumulation layers is very limited. And that's because these layers are exceptionally thin. They're literally on the nanoscale. The thicknesses could be, 10, 20 angstroms. These layers are hidden beneath other insulators. So it's very hard to measure magnetizations. Most of spectroscopic tools cannot be applied. You cannot tunnel. You cannot photoemit electrons from these layers. So these are two major problems. And over the last couple of years, we've been working with our collaborators to deal with both of these challenges, and we've made some progress in other systems, not in magnetic semiconductors yet. But I think this might be a useful know-how to make progress with these types of materials as well. First of all, we've been able to show that infrared spectroscopy is accurate enough to probe the response of injected charges in the accumulation layer. And you don't really need a system with very high mobility to observe the conductivity due to injected charges if you play some tricks with this transparent gate insulators. So this works. As for the gate insulators, we've chosen to work with organic insulators. And the advantage of these organic insulators that you don't need to have sophisticated fabrication techniques to to produce these insulators. They can be applied at room temperature to a freestanding film or crystal. And this Perelin insulator, and Michael Gershenzon was the one who has discovered this utility of organic insulators, readily allows you to inject at least 5 times 10^12 charges. That's in the first ever experiment that we've done, and I think one can improve this number by probably an order of magnitude. And another very promising type of insulators are electrolyte polymer insulators. There are several reports of charge densities in 10 to the 14th range that would be 2 orders of magnitude more than in this first experiment. Both types of insulators we were able to show are compatible with other requirements for an infrared probe of charge injection. This diagram shows an example of our ability to investigate the conductivity of accumulation layer. This is an organic FET transistor. These are different conductivity spectra. They systematically increase with applied bias voltage. The oscillator strength, the area under this conductivity, increases linearly. That's how an ideal FET structure is expected to work. So I'm bringing up these experiments because they do demonstrate that we have enough sensitivity to deal with ultra-thin layers. We should be able to do Faraday rotation measurements in the charge injection mode as well. So this opens.
Can you go to low temperature with electrolyte?
Yes, you can go to low temperature with electrolyte. In fact, they're better at low temperatures. So there are some artifacts with electrolyte itself that are no longer relevant at low temperatures. So this is a promising experiment, and I'm interested in collaborating with other groups on developing these devices for an optical probe of charge injection. So let me move to my main topic, which is the electronic structure of gallium manganese arsenide. And this diagram is intended for a brief summary of what manganese does in gallium arsenide cores. In diluted regime, it introduces resonance levels within the valence band and the shallow impurity state above the valence band. If there is more manganese, then this films becoming a ferromagnetic. They develop three temperatures around, say, 50, 60, and 70 Kelvin. And there is a general agreement that, in this case, at least, ferromagnetism is mediated by holes residing in the impurity band. This is not really in dispute, as far as I can tell from reading the literature. At issue is the story of heavier doped gallium manganese arsenide. So if you put more manganese and if you properly anneal these materials, then you see it goes up maybe as high as 180 Kelvin. And the view on the magnetic state first proposed by Dietl and by Ohner, and later also discussed in great detail by Hira Sinova and Alan MacDonald and others. The view is roughly the following. They believe that these systems are best described as metals, where Fermi energy is pushed down into the valence band and ferromagnetism is mediated by holes in nearly unperturbed valence band. And starting from this viewpoint, they have been able to describe a lot of relevant effects in this class of materials, in particular a description of trends of the Curie temperature with doping was quite impressive. Despite this success, this viewpoint has been challenged, both theoretically and experimentally. And therefore, we are facing a very uncertain situation as far as the electronic structure of gallium manganese arsenide is concerned. Where are the holes? And I think so. This question really worried us a lot, and others too. And the nature of these holes would be would be useful to decode the nature of these holes to understand the ferromagnetic state. It's also useful for practical purposes because these would be the states responsible for all spin injection applications and for spin electronics applications. So this is a relevant question, and I also think it's a well-defined question, and we should be able to give a well-defined answer to this question. Given these two possibilities for the electronic structure of heavily doped gallium manganese arsenide, it's sort of clear that the answer can be provided by some form of spectroscopy. Particular optical measurements allow us to approach this idea from two complementary perspectives. We can probe the electronic states at the Fermi energy. We also can probe transitions, interband transitions involved in these states. And I'll try to convince you that both absorption characteristics are actually very different in within these two models of the within these two approaches to the electronic structure. Yes, in the valence band of the holes. This is schematics. Don't take the position of this levels to literally. So this is schematics that hopefully will help me to illustrate different qualitative characteristics of absorption in these within these two possibilities. Yes, Greg. No, it's impossible. It's absolutely impossible because the mobility is such that your all these quantum oscillations experiments require very high mobility, and I will comment on mobility later on. It's not even close to do any of the quantum oscillations measurements. So that gives us a chance to probe effective masses because we can do it in a way that doesn't really rely that much on high mobilities. So infrared absorption methods are ideally suited for the task because all relevant energy scale falls somewhere into the frequency range that we can probe with our techniques, the techniques that we have developed over the years. To keep it short, we still call this technique infrared. This is inaccurate because the frequency range spans from sub-terahertz to UV light continuously using a set of tools that we have. Wave numbers are our jargon units for energy. So one wave number is approximately 1 Kelvin. 1,000 wave numbers is approximately 0.1 electron volts. Magnetic semiconductors are actually not the only class of materials that reveal exceptionally rich physics in the infrared region. Most of condensed matter systems do the same, both solids and soft matter. I was pleased to see a very similar diagram recently on the cover of reviews of modern physics, acknowledging the impact of similar measurements in high TC superconductivity. And there are many more examples where infrared methods have contributed to our understanding of condensed matter systems. In fact, it was realized more than two centuries ago that infrared methods are quite informative. And if you happen to browse through issues of Physical Review, and if you open volume one of Physical Review, number one on page one, then you'll find an article by Ernst Nichols dedicated to the studies of infrared absorption of certain substances of interest to physics community back in 1893. I used to show this diagram in my talks, but then I stopped doing this after I've learned that Ernst Nichols happens to be a younger brother of the founder of PhysRef. So, and maybe this has something to do with the fact that this paper got refereed a little faster than other articles submitted to Volume 1. But then I did a little bit of research, and I found out that, among other things, Nichols in this paper proposes a very new way of extracting far infrared radiation out of a black body spectrum. And this new approach later has been utilized by Rubens and Kurlbaum in their experiments, in their textbook experiments, establishing anomalies of black body radiation, anomalies that have been later described and analyzed by Max Planck. So arguably, this paper has a lot to do with something that we call modern physics. And I even included this short essay in one of my grant proposals, proposing an infrared instrument just to entertain reviewers and got it funded. So the quantitative analysis of the data relies on the examination of optical constants. All these different absorption processes give additive contributions to the spectra of the real part of the conductivity, and that's what we are really after in optical experiments. We would like to extract optical conductivity from our measurements, and I will be showing you exclusively spectra of conductivity. We know how to do it using a combination of reflectance, transmission, and ellipsometry measurements. And this diagram shows examples of the real part of the conductivity of three types of films that we investigated. All these data is at 7 Kelvin and deep in the ferromagnetic state. This is the first generation of samples that we looked around 2001. These are newer samples. In fact, this sample, as grown sample, has been split in half. Half of it has been measured in as grown form. Half of it has been annealed. And the data in the right panel shows the conductivity in the annealed form. Yes. So the data is terminated with the band gap of gallium arsenide substrate. There is also this gap here due to phonons in gallium arsenide substrate. But apart from these obstructions, there is still fairly broad frequency range that allows us to examine properties of gallium manganese arsenide film. This is a log scale. Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. I'll have some data on the linear scale as well. Yeah, it's a very asymmetric peak, heavily weighted at high energies. I'll show some data on the linear scale. These were fairly thick. These were half a micron, and these were very thin because you can only anneal maybe 400 or 500 angstrom film. If you anneal a thicker film, you don't really get any, you know, improvement of QC. So that's why this work actually was pretty hard technically. So what do we see in this spectra? First of all, we see that all these materials are on the metallic side of the metal insulator transition. In the limit of zero frequency, this is just the DC conductivity that one can measure with multimeters. A hallmark of a metallic system is, of course, the Drude response at low energies. And it was totally unclear to us how to apply this Drude model to this data. There was a lot of ambiguity, so we didn't really pursue this analysis. Here, maybe one can recognize some upturn that you would expect from the Drude model. In the annealed form, in the annealed films, this upturn is, I think, quite evident. So one immediate result of this is that we definitely observe a reduction of the scattering rate of mobile holes as the result of the annealing, which is which is sort of a natural thing to find, since annealing is believed to remove some amount of defects. Another result is this enhancement of the oscillator strength. The oscillator strength under the conductivity spectra, that according to the sum rule is proportional to the number of charges participating in absorption divided by some optical mass. And this is consistently, in particular annealing, is enhancing this spectral weight significantly. This is again a log scale, so this is a serious improvement. What is important is that the differences between these three types of materials are really quantitative. There's more spectral weight, there is maybe a narrow Drude form, but qualitatively you observe the same behavior, same type of behavior in all three types of samples. And this is easy to illustrate the generally similar character of all these films by scaling the data, and this is a linear plot now. So the scaling protocol that Kenny Birch has used here divided the frequency axis by the position of the peak, and the vertical axis he normalized by the amplitude of this peak. So the peak is indeed very asymmetric, very broad, still, and is observed in all materials that we have investigated so far, both old ones and new ones. So we believe that this peak really contains a lot of important information about the electronic structure of gallium manganese arsenide, and that's what I would like to tell you next. One can explain the qualitative features of this conductivity starting from the viewpoint of the impurity band. If you have a partially filled band, you would naturally expect to find some form of Drude response, whereas interband transitions to EF from the valence band can account for this structure. And that's what we proposed a long time ago, but it was pointed to us by Hira and by Allen that this is not the only option. And this viewpoint of the electronic structure with transitions involving light and heavy holes in the valence band of the host can produce a very similar, qualitatively similar form. They will produce an interband structure approximately in the same frequency range. And of course, this system has a partially filled band, so you would naturally expect some form of Drude conductivity. So you can expect the same qualitative features from very different starting points. And basically what this is telling you is that you cannot really discriminate between the two approaches based on the analysis of the line shape alone. So you have to do something else. What peak high? Peak height I think peak height is the hardest to interpret. So maybe the total oscillator strength, because depending on, again, on impurities, the height can vary dramatically. So what we've chosen to do, one of the things we've chosen to do, we try to analyze the total spectral weight contained in the conductivity and also the position of this peak. So let me tell you what happens to the position of the peak within the two scenarios. So if you have holes in the valence band, and if you increase the density of holes, and you move the Fermi energy down, the energy of these transitions should increase. So you would expect a blue shift within the valence band scenario. And this is a very well-known effect. It goes back to the late 50s in epidote gallium arsenide, and recently it has been revisited by a group from Virginia Tech in doping concentrations of relevance for us. Not surprisingly, the calculations by Hira and by Allen also produced the hardening of this mode. And this is different from what we observe in experiments. So here I'm trying to show data for many of materials that we investigated over broad doping range. So if you examine the position of this peak, there is The hardening is not found. In fact, the peak is softens approximately by 1,000 wave number. So this is the position of this peak, plotted as a function of carrier density in a similar fashion to the theory plot. And you can recognize from this diagram the opposite trend. The peak softens with increasing carrier concentration. Also, if we start comparing absolute values, at least at high dopings, this peak is too low to be consistent with an intervalence transition. So we, from this analysis, we are basically forced to conclude that intervalence transitions cannot account for this feature. Yes. It shows bigger in the sense that there is more spectral rate, but it's actually broader there. So if you try to do the analysis, then you find that the scattering rate is larger in 7% compared to 5%, which probably also makes sense. After all, you have more disorder in this more dopants in this sample. No, I'm not. Yeah. Okay, so we are forced to conclude that the impurity band, we cannot understand the doping trend within the valence band picture. So we are forced to conclude that the impurity band perhaps survives in these heavily doped samples with high Curie temperatures. So what reinforces this conclusion is the following. Now we can easily separate two contributions to the conductivity. Maybe not very easily, but there are some features that. This. Oh yeah. Yeah, that's because that I don't want to talk about this about. Okay, that's a valid remark, and there are some other. I guess I was going to show this plot because this is the conductivity for the impurity band model, and here you get a redshift similar to the data. Yeah. This theory does account for optical properties, does not account for trends in PC. That's a fair remark.
The theory by Hyrule includes all the physics, because there's a lot of things that are
Yeah, we are certainly waiting for your input in the whole story. That's what makes it interesting. So now I'll try to separate the interband part due to the impurity band and intraband part. And what I'll try to do, I'll try to integrate this spectral weight, and you can sort of define a cutoff in a semi-arbitrary fashion, if you wish, for the intraband absorption. But the point is that not much will really depend on this cutoff. If I integrate this part, I should be able to get P over M star, carrier density over M star, from the oscillator strength sum rule. So this gives us the spectral weight, the low energy spectral weight, at least in principle, gives us access to M star values. We need an independent P for that, and we tried to get it from Raman, and we failed in this particular film. So what we are doing instead, we are trying to get P from the work of Peter and Nitin Samarath on similar films using same protocol and annealing protocol. And I think I'm prepared to accept a factor of 2 or even 5 for sample dependence of P. And no matter what this factor will be, I'll get a range of masses for this corresponding to this Drude absorption that tells me that these masses are basically huge. I'm not insisting on particular numbers here. I'm giving the range just to indicate that this mass is way beyond the mass of holes in the valence band of gallium arsenide, which is supposed to be 0.3. Now, a fair question to ask, if these masses make any sense in terms of what we know about transport of gallium manganese arsenide. And I think transport has been looked in great details. I think all groups would agree that this at high doping levels carry density somewhere high 10 to the 20th, maybe 10 to the 21st. This would imply that even in the best, most metallic, most conducting films, mobility is of the order of 1 or maybe 5 centimeters squared per volts per second. This is a very low mobility. Doesn't really do much, frankly, and it doesn't do much within the error bars that we have for this mass. That is maybe a factor of 3 or 4 or something like this. So within this huge error bars, it's really hard to analyze the doping trends of the mass. You can say that maybe annealing. Yeah, it's. I think there are some signs of that. Yes, it's actually in at 7% in non-annealed film, it's very hard to identify the Drude contribution in the first place. So we don't. Well, annealing is a criterion for annealing is very simple. That's increase of TC. So that's, and the increase of TC that we get in these films is as good as in the best films. But the annealing trends of the mass, I don't really have enough accuracy for the mass to discuss that. So mobility is low. Mobility is of the order of amorphous silicon or polymers. On the other hand, mobility of the p-doped gas in the same concentration of charge carriers is two orders of magnitude higher. And you can understand, if you look what factors are actually entering mobility, then it's tau, of course, and m star. And I have all reasons to believe that tau is not the dominant contribution to this low mobility. It contributes, of course, but it's not the only one. And we see that from fairly small scattering rates here. We also can analyze the critical points in the band structure using infrared ellipsometry. The point is that these critical points, due to several Van Hoff singularities in the electronic structure, they are completely wiped out in disordered films. What you see instead in gallium manganese arsenide that most of them are preserved, and even at the level of 6%. So we do not believe that these films are amorphous. There are no indications that these films are amorphous or heavily disordered. And so we believe that these high effective masses may be the dominant contribution to low mobility. So I summarized here several results that support this story of the impurity band. And these experiments on magnetic circular dichroism carried out in David's group here a long time ago indicated a very interesting anomaly in the 1.5 range. This was analyzed by Tang and by Flatte later on and has been shown to be consistent with a impurity band perhaps overlapping the valence band of the Gallium-Arsenide host. But the emission experiments also point to the existence of the impurity band. Our experiments carried out approximately at the same time with a group of Tokyo produce infrared evidence for that. There's more results from photoelectron photoluminescence, from STM, and finally tunneling. All these experiments seem to indicate. Yes. Yeah, I know this. I know this PRL, and I think, and I know these other alternative explanation. It's true that ARPIS hasn't been done on the new generation of films, and it's. I think it's a very, would be a very important experiment to do. What experiments on new samples, on infrared data for new samples, seem to suggest to me at least. So that. Some of the extrinsic interpretations of the earlier data are not necessarily the most accurate ones. So we do not find in our data any qualitative difference between these early heavily compensated, heavily disordered samples and the new ones. There are subtle differences. There are differences in the spectral weightings. There are differences in numbers. There are no differences in the qualitative trends. I don't want you to hold. Yeah, and I think what's important in this work is that even though that's not ferromagnetic gallium manganese arsenide, the spacing between manganese on gallium arsenide surface is comparable to what you do find in ferromagnetic samples. So this experiment has been just designed differently, but it addresses very relevant spacing between manganese. So. I think with all these, the story for the impurity band is a solid one, and in this analysis, the only deficiency I see in our analysis, as well as some other spectroscopies, is that in all these works, gallium manganese arsenide field is assumed to be homogeneous. And it doesn't have to be the same. It doesn't have to be like that. And even though we don't have, it's obvious that we don't have clusters of manganese here. Manganese clusters would be easily to detect. But electronic phase separation on a more subtle level may be much harder to detect. And this is an example of why it's so hard to detect. Here again, I show that it's the imaginary part of the dielectric function. It's same as conductivity within the factor of frequency. The black line is pristine gallium arsenide. blue line is heavily doped gallium manganese arsenide. There is basically not enough contrast between these two different electronic phases. So in this range, of course, it's easy to do the scanning probe techniques. So I think our best hope to identify this would be turned to mid-infrared range, where there is a radical difference between lightly doped samples and heavily doped samples, difference in several orders of magnitude. And if we assume that this data has been averaged for phases with different compositions, the actual difference can be even stronger. So we are in the process of building near-field scanning microscope tools operating with quantum cascade lasers at these frequencies, and hopefully we will be able to give you more definitive answers on the electronic phase separation. Let me summarize. discuss some of the implications of these results for the understanding of the ferromagnetic state. I think the impurity band is a right starting point. Several experiments would strongly support this point. So one can maybe argue with ARPIS and maybe with MCD, but it's definitely here and here. The case for the impurity band is very solid, and transport data would support that. In order to understand magnetic state, it's imperative to understand the metal insulator transition here. And metal insulator transitions seem to be very unconventional in gallium manganese arsenide. In all other cases of heavily doped P gas, heavily doped gallium arsenide with holes, these holes indeed reside in the valence band. And as far as I know, this manganese is the only exception. I think experimentally it's well documented. I don't think it's well understood theoretically. So I mentioned about disorder, and disorder is clearly an important factor here. What is important, I think, that even most heavily disordered materials that are on the show localization trends still reveal ferromagnetism at fairly high temperatures. So this probably suggests that it would be useful to have the same mechanism describing ferromagnetic state in both metallic and localized samples. And this is the issue, I think, that experimentalists have to really pay attention to. Thank you very much for your attention. So it's in the conductivity data. This peak is definitely spread out on the high energy side. It's inferring. I don't think this peak necessarily reflects the picture of the density of state, because this is the conductivity and momentum and selection rules are not necessarily completely ignored here, as we can show from the Van 't Hoff singularities in the visible range and in the UV range. So, okay. Even then, if you still allow I think energy is frequency. Even if you allow for transitions between some spikes between density of states, you get this weighting at high energy. You get an onset for transitions, and then they can go on much further in energy from the onset. So I think the peak is always asymmetric when you have an interband transition. But I would be very I would be very interested to have some maybe theory input on the form of the peak that can be expected, so that we can analyze this data in more detail. It's, this Lorentzian analysis of this peak is just it's the zeroth order approximation. I totally agree with you that one should look at the whole picture, and you've done a great job in analyzing huge amounts of data, and I don't think these are completely isolated incidents of appearance of the and these high effective masses, if we can understand them within the valence band, well, we'll probably be forced to conclude that Gelin-Menges arsenide is a heavy fermion, ferromagnet. So then if this is all many body, then these many body effects are stronger than in this uranium compounds or comparable. So if that's the case, well, maybe that will make the whole thing more interesting. So, but I totally agree with you that one should look at the whole picture. Correct? There are several, factors that have to be added to the theoretical. That's right. The ball is in your court, Hyatt. So So just like it was in our court before we measured all these samples, you've been telling us this for a couple of years that we have to do it. And Greg, I agree with you. I think it's inconceivable that this valence band really resides well isolated from the impurity band resides within the gap isolated from the valence band. It must be, you know, fairly broadened at this type of concentration. So there is definitely overlap and some more complicated effects may be happening. We just need some framework to compare to. In this sense, you know, HIRA has done most work on the system, so we can compare in details with their predictions and found some issues here. But we are expecting, you know, similarly detailed theoretical predictions for other possibilities of the electronic structure. They are not there yet.
Yes.
Well, for time of flight measurements in organic conductors, you need to have, if you refer to organic molecular crystals, where time of flight measurements were used to probe mobilities and to report mobilities of the order of few hundreds centimeters squared per volt per second. This is the type of mobility values you need to have ballistic propagation of, you know, charges through your crystal. So we are not there yet by a few orders of magnitude. So optical experiment is really the one that's giving you most directly some information on effective masses in this case, and we are surprised to see these masses as high as they are. I think specific heat on thin films is not very straightforward. So you have to prepare a film on a. People are doing specific heat on thin films, but you have to fabricate your film on your specific heat device. And you know, there may be one or two groups that are capable of doing this. It's not obvious that gallium manganese arsenide will draw on these devices that I think gallium nitride devices. I don't know if it will draw or not. Maybe you don't know. I don't. Not yet. Okay, that's a good answer.